I wonder if you've ever been in a situation where you've had to make a decision, a choice, between two or three good alternatives. I remember one time sitting at a finance meeting of a large church around 10 or 15 years ago. The church was wealthy, and they'd managed to accumulate quite a lot of spare cash, about £500,000. And the finance team were now in the tricky position of presenting to the congregation various choices of how the money could be spent. What a happy problem to have, you might think. The church building was large, it could seat around 600 or so, but it was filling up. So one proposal was to build a kind of balcony at the back to add a second tier, and they reckoned they could get another couple of hundred people in there. Another plan was to revamp the aging organ. Still another was to employ one or two more members of staff, and so it went. Decisions like that can be really hard sometimes. I wonder if you were sat on their PCC, their council, who had to make those decisions, I wonder what call you would make and what decision you would come up with. £500,000 to spend on your church. Decisions, decisions. Well, as I sat there, it was fascinating listening to people coming up to the front, explaining their point of view and giving their reasons why they thought their proposal ought to go ahead and would be the right option. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just take out a pocket-sized crystal ball sometimes, give it a rub and look into it and get the right answer every time? Alas, God in his wisdom has not given us a crystal ball, but he has told us what is important. And from that we can derive priorities. And to find out what is important, let's turn to Matthew 26. Now, I don't know if you know, maybe you do know, but Matthew is divided into five blocks of Jesus' teaching. You might have heard, for example, of the Sermon on the Mount. Well, that's the first block of Jesus' teaching in Matthew, and then there's a second one, a third one, and so on. Now, the fifth block is the final block, and it finishes right before our passage begins at the end of chapter 25, and it's all about the coming judgment. The coming judgment when Jesus will return. And every time a block of teaching finishes, it finishes with a little formula, which you'll see in the first verse of chapter 26, when Jesus had finished all these things, saying all these things. It's like a sort of little signature sign-off type of thing. So basically, we're picking up Matthew after all of the teaching blocks have finished, but it doesn't mean that the book is finished, because there's still a few chapters left, the last few days of Jesus' life with us, and it tells us all about his priorities and what he thought was important. Anyway, that just gives you a kind of quick bird's eye view of where we are in Matthew. We're right at the end of the book, as you may have gathered, right before the crucifixion. Anyway, chapter 26 gets going in a very strange way, you might think. Let's pick it up at verse 2. As you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. Now that may not strike you as a very strange thing to say, but that's because we're not first century Jews. Saying back then to a Jew, you know that in 2 days' time it's going to be the Passover, is a bit like saying to an Englishman on December the 23rd, you know that in 2 days' time it's going to be Christmas. To which any Englishman would say, of course I know that. It's part of our cultures. We know it back to front. Of course the Passover is in 2 days' time. It states the obvious. However, even though that they knew the Passover was coming up, and even though they'd celebrated the Passover every single year since they were knee-high to a grasshopper, they failed to see the significance of it. In particular, they failed to see what Jesus had to do with the Passover, and it turned out to be quite a serious mistake. It's a mistake, incidentally, which is made the world over today, and it's a really common mistake, and it's really worth getting this one clear, because it summarizes all of Jesus' priorities, and it's simply this: that God's Passover lamb is at the center of God's plans. Our only point for tonight. God's Passover lamb is at the center of God's plans. Now, We're not Jewish, most of us, I imagine, so we need to remind ourselves of what the Passover was originally about. We have to go back a couple of thousand years before Jesus was born. Back in the Exodus, the Israelites were slaves in Egypt, and they were commanded to sacrifice a lamb the night that they left Egypt. And the blood of the lamb would be wiped on the doorposts of the house, and the rest of the lamb would be roasted over the fire and then eaten. And that night an angel went across the land with the task of striking down every firstborn child in every house, both Israelite and Egyptian. But because the Israelites had already sacrificed a lamb and marked their doorposts with the blood of the lamb, the angel of death would see the blood and pass over that house, hence the name Passover, since bloodshed had already occurred there. Now put up your hand if you're the firstborn in your family. I'm the firstborn in mine. Yeah, a couple people. Some people are the firstborn. I mean, you'd really want your dad to be on the ball on this one, wouldn't you? Can you imagine on the night, on the day, it's getting late in the afternoon, imagine being born into a family where your father was Mr. Casual and he hadn't really gotten round to sacrificing the lamb yet. And you were looking at your watch going, Dad, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, get a move on. And he's like, yeah, I'll get it done. And it gets to 5:30 and, you know, the sun's beginning to set. And you're like, Dad, the angel of death's on his way, get a move on. And he's like, yeah, I'll get it done. And then can you imagine the relief as Larry the lamb is finally slaughtered and that blood goes on the doorpost and you go, oh. As you know, the angel will pass over your house and you'll be safe. Once you get the idea that the sacrifice of that lamb is essential, because there's no other way the angel of death is going to pass over your property, it doesn't matter how cute and how fluffy Larry the lamb is, that lamb has got to be sacrificed. It's either you or the lamb. It's going to be the lamb. It's got to die. And in remembrance of that great event, the Passover meal was celebrated annually from then on every single year. In fact, it was compulsory for Jewish males to go to Jerusalem once a year for the feast. And so once a year in Jerusalem, there'd be this gigantic, huge swell of travelers coming in to celebrate the Passover feast. But had they remembered what the Passover was all about? Or were they just going through the motions? Were they just going along for a party, a knees up in Jerusalem once a year? In particular, had they remembered that Jesus was the true Passover lamb who would die and avert God's wrath to save them? Had they understood how important his death was? Had they understood that God's Passover lamb is at the center of God's plans? Well, had they? Actually, not doing too well on this one. We're going to stick with our main point tonight, but we're going to follow it through the eyes of four groups of different people. We'll be brief, but let's just see how they get on with this truth. First of all, we'll look at the proud religious in verses 3 to 5. Let's look at verse 3. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas. And they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. Caiaphas was the high priest of the time. He was a very highly respected man. He was like the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope combined together on steroids. He was the religious granddaddy of them all. You did not want to mess with the high priest. There was nobody higher than him. And Caiaphas, verse 3, is in this palace. Notice he gets his own palace. And he's there with his sort of entourage around him. They're plotting the death of Jesus. But not because they understand that God's Passover lamb is at the center of God's plans. That's not the reason. They're plotting because they hated competition. As simple as that. They did it out of wickedness. And this makes the basic point that some of the most religious people in the world can be the most opposed to Jesus. being given a special title or wearing special religious clothing is absolutely no guarantee of being a Christian. These people were wicked. They hated Jesus. They wanted to murder him in some back alley, even though the law forbid murder, and they were in charge of preaching the law. Oh, the irony. But notice their weakness. Notice their weakness. They know that they can't get away with this murder during the Passover feast. Josephus, the historian, reckoned that the population of Jerusalem could swell to anything up to 3 million during the Passover feast. And if you've ever been to Jerusalem, you'll know that the old city of David is not a particularly big place. Roughly about the same size as Stapenhill. And a stampede of 3 million people could easily tear the city apart. So who's in control of this situation? Certainly not the religious leaders. And even when they get their way a few days later, they just end up playing right into God's hands because he uses their wickedness to fulfill his own plans through Jesus' death. Who's really in control? Well, not the proud religious. They're doing their own thing, but they're not good people. Secondly, let's look at it through the eyes of the sacrificial woman in verse 6. While Jesus was in Bethany, not far from Jerusalem, in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. Well, this woman, this delightful woman, acts in the exact opposite way to the religious leaders, and her reaction to Jesus is one of the most beautiful in the whole of the New Testament. It must have greatly pleased Jesus himself because he pays her such a nice compliment later on, which we'll come to at the end. First of all, let's just consider the basic facts of what she actually did. She took an alabaster jar. Now, alabaster is a kind of calcite material used for making pots. In other words, it was a posh pot made for holding an expensive cosmetic. And what's inside the jar is this kind of expensive ointment, very expensive ointment, as Matthew tells us. He doesn't actually tell us how much it cost, but if it's the same incident as is recorded in the other Gospels, then we know that it was worth a year's wages. So around £20,000 by today's standards. No doubt this was one of her few treasures. She'd probably kept this pot hidden away for a very long time. And what does she do with it? Dab a little bit on herself each day to keep the wrinkles at bay? No, she gives away the whole lot and puts it on Jesus' head. Why does Matthew tell us that it went on Jesus' head? Well, probably because that's the way you anoint a king. She was anointing her king for his burial. It cost her everything. But no cost was too high for the King of Kings. She understood the worth of her perfume, and she understood the worth of Jesus. No cost was too high for the King of Kings. No expense too great. And she gave it all away and gave it right to him. Thirdly, the dopey disciples in verses 8 and 9. Now they see this and they immediately criticize her. Verse 8, when the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste? They asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. Out of all the people groups, the disciples were in the most privileged position to understand why Jesus had to die. They had spent the most time with him, roughly about 3 years. He had mentioned his death on numerous occasions, but they still didn't get it. And the most telling thing they say comes in verse 8. Why this waste? That word, waste, really sums up their view of Jesus at this point. He's nothing special. He's just one of us. Why not sell the perfume to those people who need it? Give the money to the poor. And to be fair, there were lots of poor people back then, and it's true, there was no welfare system to soften the blow. But it's clear how they evaluated things. Poor people ranked higher than Jesus. Why this waste? And finally, we come to the greedy Judas in verses 14 to 16. This is what he does. Then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" So they counted for him 30 silver coins. And from then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Now, this point is an obvious point, but it just needs to be said. Judas was one of the 12 apostles. He had seen what they had seen. He had heard the same sermons that they had heard. Doubtless, he'd spoken to Jesus on many occasions privately. He had had all of the privileges of any other apostle or any other disciple. And his conclusion is a striking one. He goes to the chief priest and says, "What will you give me for him?" No doubt he was slightly jealous to see so much money being poured on Jesus' head, so he seeks financial compensation. And what he gets offered is 30 pieces of silver, which isn't very much. In today's money, it's about £3,000. £3,000 to hand over the King of Kings. £3,000. It's about the price of a cheap car, cheap second-hand car. That's what Jesus was worth to him. And as somebody who had been brought up on the Torah, on the Old Testament law, he must have known only too well that 30 pieces of silver is exactly how much it costs for a slave, according to Exodus 21. That's all Jesus was worth to him. Cost of a slave. He might have thought to himself, well, if he's about to die anyway, he might as well get some cash for it, help him on his way. And as we reflect on what this means for us, we need to reflect deeply on the main point that that God's Passover lamb is at the center of God's plans, because most of the people in this account just simply did not get that. Or if you want to put it more simply, the cross is at the center of God's plans, because that's what it means to be a Passover lamb. A Passover lamb has to die. That's what it means. And the whole purpose of Jesus being born in the first place was ultimately so that he would die. Now, the placing of Matthew 26 directly after the fifth teaching block in the book really sharpens this point. If the fifth teaching block is about judgment, and Matthew 26 is about the cross, which is basically how we escape judgment, we begin to see why the centrality of the cross is so important. It is our one and only means of escape from the coming judgment. And anything which tries to trump the cross in terms of importance is bound to be very dangerous because it threatens our salvation. Imagine, if you will, a large ferry, you know, like a large passenger ferry in the sea. And imagine that it's sinking for whatever reason. And there are a whole load of passengers on there who can only escape safely by following a very exact procedure. Well, basically, any other announcement given at that time is a menace. Don't want to know that the canteen is serving food right now. Not interested that Snow White is going to be showing in 10 minutes' time in the ship's cinema. Only one thing matters. How do we get off that ship? And likewise, anything which trumps the central point that God's Passover lamb is at the center of God's plans is a menace. Now, we need to think about what this means for us today. And the short answer is it must be that we should be on guard about anything which pushes the cross off center stage in church life. And I've got 2 points of application which are kind of based upon this idea of keeping the cross central. And the first one is this. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. The cross is the main thing, of course. And the main thing is to keep the cross the main thing at the center. So the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. We don't want anything else to take over and become the main thing. We want the cross to be at the center, the main thing. And if you look at what's at the heart of many churches, sadly, Anglican churches sometimes, it's quite often not the cross of Christ. Jesus is mentioned regularly. The Bible is opened, but they have concerns which are kind of off-center. We're a church that reaches out to the poor. We're a church that stands up for what people believe. We're a community church. We're a church which is about engaging with the culture of today, and so on and so on. All really, really good things. But off-center, if they're driving what's going on. And what happens is that the cross gets shoved to one side. And instead of being a cross-shaped church with genuine human concerns flowing from that, it becomes a church shaped by human concerns, which occasionally mentions the cross. See the difference? They're quite different. Well, before we get smug and think that we've avoided slipping, statistically it seems to happen that most churches veer off if you give them enough time. The heart of the gospel, the cross of Christ, seems to get relegated quite easily to second or even third place. Something else comes along and stops the main thing from being the main thing. And our task, of course, is to do the opposite of that and to make sure that the main thing is the main thing. And that's the main thing that we've got to do, is to keep the main thing the main thing. We mustn't let anything else trump that and get in the middle. Now you might be thinking to yourself, well, how does it happen then that something comes along and trumps the cross? How is it that the death of Jesus can get pushed to one side? What could it be that could make the main thing not the main thing anymore? And this kind of leads to my second point of application, which is this. The enemy of the best is the good. Let me explain. It's very rare in life, and this doesn't just apply to Christianity, but really to anything, but it's very rare that a bad option will steal the limelight and take the center stage off the best option. So applying it to our passage, for example, imagine that the disciples had gone to Jesus, and imagine after the woman had poured her ointment on his head, imagine if they'd said to him, why all this waste of money? Let's give the money to Judas so he can buy himself a nice chariot. Or if they'd said, why not give the money to the Roman Empire so that they can chase us around the country with their horses or something like that? Or why don't we just gamble it away? And immediately everyone would have said, that's a terrible idea. Let's not do that. Don't be so stupid. You see, nobody is fooled by a bad option. But if you can find a good suggestion, especially one that's got a bit of emotional content to it, let's give the money to the poor. They've got nothing, the poor things. And suddenly, you've got a very dangerous alternative that people will follow. And it could sidetrack everybody. The church that had £500,000 to spare finally did come to a decision. It turned out in the end that the building works were too expensive and employing another member of staff didn't please the congregation, so their final decision was to revamp the organ. What eventually persuaded everyone was that it needed doing. The organ was old, and also they felt that good music attracts people in, which is true, I suppose, and they also believed that people in the area knew that the church was renowned for its good music and they came expecting nothing but the best. And so it all seemed to fit together and that's where the money got spent. Now, I think there's a lot of very good points in their reasoning, perhaps. But that's exactly the problem. Because it's a classic example of a good option dominating and taking over center stage. it was not obvious from going to that church that the cross was at the centre of what they believed and proclaimed. If it had been, maybe they would have spent the money on the organ anyway. But maybe not. And without any doubt at all, their aims and their concerns and their sort of logic of reasoning would definitely have been different. I mean, looking back, the Bible teaching wasn't that great, and 600 people could fit in the pews, but there are only about 50 or 60 Bibles in the church. You would think that there were higher priorities to spend the money on, like maybe they could have got someone in to train people up, or just bought more Bibles, or I don't know, started a group to meet together to study the Word. I don't know, but something. If God's main concern centers around the death of his Son, and it is, then our main concern should center around the death of Jesus's, around the death of Jesus as well. Now, it could be that you're sat here thinking, well, I'm not actually persuaded that the cross is at the center. I mean, isn't it a bit arbitrary? Haven't we just plucked something out of thin air from the story? Well, let's see how Jesus finishes as he talks to this most remarkable woman in verses 10 and 13, down to 10 to 13. This, of course, is just after she's been accused by the disciples of wasting money. Aware of this, Jesus said to them, "Why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing to me." See what he does there? Immediately he defends her. Why are you bothering her? Leave her alone. Get off her back. And this is the point he makes. "The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me." See what he does? He's not saying don't give money to the poor. That's not the point of this talk at all. It's a good thing to give money to the poor. That's not the point of what we're saying. The point is, it is good to give money to the poor. That's the problem. "But you won't always have me," he says. Verse 12. "When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial." You see there, she knows exactly why she is doing this. She could have taken that pot, she could have given the money to the poor at any time, but she didn't. She saved it for this very day. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was preparing the King of Kings for his burial. Verse 13, "I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." This woman was a smart cookie. She knew what the best option was. She could have sold the pot of perfume, the pot of ointment, but she didn't. She saved it. And what a compliment she's paid. And the sermon, of course, proves how true Jesus' words were, because wherever the gospel is proclaimed, there she is mentioned in memory of her. What a wonderful thing to be remembered for. She understood very clearly that God's Passover lamb is at the center of God's plans. And although there were many good things she could have done, she wanted to do the best thing. And that's exactly what she did. And she got remembered until Jesus will return again. She will be told about as the woman who anointed the King of Kings for his burial. Let's close in prayer.